You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The success of the recent rebellions in Tunisia and Egypt has left many wondering what will happen next. Despite having expanded their economies over the past two decades, both countries suffer from weak labor markets and a growing youth population. In his latest article, Profit Motive, spelled P-R-O-P-H-E-T, New Yorker staff writer John Cassidy takes a historical look at the Middle East and economic infrastructure and whether, as some argue, Islam has played a role in impeding the region's economic development. I'm very pleased to welcome John Cassidy back to our show. It's always a pleasure to see you, John.
Thanks for inviting me back, Leonard.
Where do countries in the Middle East stand in comparison to economies in other parts of the world?
Well, they're sort of in the middle to the bottom. They're not the very poorest. They're richer than most of the countries in Africa. They're about on the same level as Latin America. Usually GDP is about $5,000 or $6,000 per capita.
Well, in Latin America, there's only one. Well, Mexico had some oil, but right. Venezuela is the only really oil rich company. In the Middle East, we have a number of oil rich countries.
That's what biases the statistics, because obviously some of the Middle Eastern countries, such as Saudi Arabia and Kuwait, are actually very rich because they've got enormous reservoirs of oil. Other countries such as Sudan and Egypt, which have much less oil, are, you know, are much poorer on a per capita basis. So, you know, one of the problems with looking at the Middle East is it's two places. It's very different whether you have oil or whether you don't have oil.
So, the countries that don't have oil, what do they tend to base their economies on? Agriculture?
Traditionally, they've been agriculture. Certainly, in the Maghreb, places like Libya and Tunisia and Egypt itself, where Egypt's long been a big exporter of sort of market gardening, because you know you've got the Mediterranean climate there, so they can make a lot of fruit and vegetables.
And Egyptian cotton is preferred.
Yeah, well, I mean, one of the things I mentioned in the piece is the sort of history of the Egyptian cotton industry. It's actually very interesting because back in the 19th century, they had an Albanian who took over there, Mehmet Ali, and he tried to build up the cotton industry and did a very good job. It's, you know, Egyptian cotton, as you say, is pretty good, but he got knocked down by the British, who persuaded the emperor in Constantinople to impose big tariffs on Egyptian goods. So that argument, you know, that's sort of the argument that colonialism and the sort of imperial system played a role in keeping these countries down rather than religion. I mean, I don't think there's any one monocausal explanation of why the Middle East is trailing everybody else. But, you know, I just think this emphasis that a lot of people put on religion is overstated.
Well, don't many of the oil-rich countries also have economic problems? It's been said that oil can be a curse.
Yeah, I mean, it's the fact that the economists refer to it as the oil curse. You'd think it's great to, you know, discover oil. It's like discovering gold. It's worth, you know, a fortune, $100 a barrel now, last few days since the events in Libya. The problem is it always causes big economic, big political and economic problems because people fight over the oil. That's the curse. It leads to civil wars. It leads to corrupt elites and despots sort of taking over so they can steal all the oil themselves and put all the money in Swiss banks, etc. I mean, now we see in Egypt, which has a bit of oil but not that much, you know, people saying, where's Mubarak's billions? Did he hide it all in Switzerland or not? We'll have the if Gaddafi eventually does go in Libya, the same dispute will, you know, happen there because Libya does have quite a lot of oil.
Well, except for Iran, haven't the oil-rich countries in the Middle East been governed by royal families and totalitarian leaders who take most of the money with little of it trickling down to the subject?
Well, I mean, we're sort of skating over it there, aren't we, when we say haven't they been ruled? When I say the British and the Americans, we put most of these monarchs into place after the First World War, specifically for the purpose of generating a stable supply of oil in these countries, which were, you know, they weren't even really countries. A lot of them, they were just lines drawn on a map and in the Treaty of Versailles after the First World War. So again, you know, that's another problem. Obviously, as you say completely rightly, most of the money in Saudi Arabia and other places has gone into the pockets of the royal family, and especially in places where there is a sort of religious division. In Bahrain, for example, where you have the you know, a Sunni monarchy and the working class is Shiite, very little has trickled down to the poor people.
And we talk about the unfair situation in Kashmir in that regard, where a Hindu government was instituted after partition, although most of the people were Muslims. So is this really – that's another legacy of colonialism.
Again, that's another colonial argument, sure. I mean, a lot of these countries, you know, were – Pakistan and Kashmir, you know, is a classic example, obviously. You know, it was basically a bit of India carved out there. These countries are fighting various sort of historical legacies. They do have the legacy of Islam. They have the legacy of colonialism. And they also have the legacy of a sort of misguided, very rigid sort of state socialism in some countries in the 20th century. You know, Libya, Gaddafi, for example, modeled himself as a sort of, you know, socialist leader, which, you know, a lot of it was bogus. He was skimming a lot off the top himself, it seems like.
Other than nationalizing the oil industry, doesn't seem to have instituted much socialism. Well, but has dependence on oil revenues by many of these countries prevented them from opening up their economies to the private sector?
Well, the problem is, you know, if you have Saudi Arabia, for example, the oil revenue is just so enormous that it puts upward pressure on the exchange rate. The rest of your goods are not at all competitive, because you have an overvalued currency. Number two, there's just so much money around that if you're on the inside, there's no incentive to actually go out and do anything entrepreneurial and work. You know, there's thousands of Saudi princes who are all indirectly or actually directly, you know, being financed by the oil revenues. So you basically have a sort of kleptocratic regime at the top of a lot of these countries who just survive on the oil revenues. That's, you know, Egypt and Tunisia are sort of counterexamples to that, because Egypt doesn't have that much oil and Tunisia had very little. But as I say, you've got to be, you know, careful how you specify which country.
Well, in Iran, the Shah tried to use the oil revenues to modernize the country, and that was met with resistance. Well, was that religious resistance? Was that traditional resistance? Or just simply that people hated the Shah?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't, you know, try to picture myself as a great sort of expert on the history of Iran, but from what I know of it and from what we've seen, obviously, you know, the great rural masses never accepted the Shah, and they were, you know, really old-fashioned religious, not about fundamentalists, but certainly old-fashioned religious people, and they all saw the Shah for what he was, you know, a sort of person who'd been imposed on them by the West. So
again, the Brits. I hate to keep on saying this to you. You are British.
Oh, no. Well, I mean, a lot of people, you know, say the British, you know, well, I'm actually Irish descent, Leonard, but I do have an English passport, and I am English. I was brought up in England. So I'll take some responsibility for the historic legacy of British colonialism, yeah.
I have staff members who have paintballs that are going to be shooting at you later. You spent some time looking at scholarly research supporting the notion that Islamic religious ideology restricted economic progress. And the suggestion has been that there's been a resistance to modernity in many of these countries, or if by modernity we mean Western thought.
Well, we basically mean a resistance to Western capitalism, I think, is how it's usually, you know, it's usually formulated. I mean, it's obviously, you know, a very sort of long-standing debate, which has got sort of very controversial after 9/11 when people like Bernard Lewis got involved in it. I'm not saying I'm as expert in the history of a lot of these countries, a lot of these people who are involved in it. I'm just coming in looking at it from an economic point of view. And it seems to me that, you know, sure, religion plays a role in some things. But if you just look around the world, lots of countries that seem to be sort of religion, if not fundamentalist, very old-fashioned religious countries in the past have become very modern. I give you the example of Ireland, for example, where, you know, for decades people said Roman Catholicism is holding back Ireland. Well, as soon as the government sort of deregulated and they became part of the EC and people saw it was easy to make money, turned out the Irish were incredibly entrepreneurial and, you know, they had the Irish tiger economy for 20, 30 years.
And now they're suffering as a result. There weren't enough restraints.
Well, of course there weren't. I mean, it turned out that they were bigger speculators than anybody else and they had the biggest property bubble in the world and, you know, they had 10 years of genuine prosperity and 10 years of fake prosperity.
My guest is John Cassidy, whose article, Profit Motive, is in the current issue of The New Yorker. You spent some time looking at scholarly works. What specifically does the Quran say about issues related to money? As I understand it, and forgive me for laying it out because you don't have any piece of paper in front of you, Sharia law sounds pretty fair. Money cannot grow by itself. That is no compounding interest.
Right.
Trade is okay as long as equal amounts of money are traded. Transactions that can be seen as unfair to either lender or borrower are not okay. Right. Risks must be shared. No investing in morally questionable companies is allowed. Of Of course, that doesn't apply to the kings, the sheikhs, and the dictators.
Right, exactly. I mean, you know, it depends how you, as with all religious texts, it depends how you interpret them. Some of the Quran has proved sort of a barrier to various types of business. The ban on interest, you know, is real. And in a lot of these countries, you know, you can't just go to a bank and deposit your money at 2% interest rate for the year because that's against Sharia law.
What about borrowing money?
Well, it's the same thing. There are ways around it. The point I'm making, or the point, and most of the people actually involved in this debate accept this, that the sort of interest argument is a bit of a canard because the people and businesses in these countries have found ways around it. For example, they don't borrow, but they have sort of sale and lease back agreements, which amount to borrowing at interest, but you buy it cheaply up front and then agree to pay it back more expensively in the future, which effectively is paying interest, but it's not a sort of income stream that's paid out every month.
So if someone involved in Islamic finance wants to get a car loan or a credit card or insurance?
Well, it depends. I mean, for a long time, those things didn't exist. They do now to more extent. Credit cards are becoming more popular in the sort of rich parts of these countries. But as I say, there were always various ways around it. Sort of, there's an enormous industry now in the Middle East, and a lot of it's based in London, called Sharia compliant finance. Mm-hmm. And it's basically just creating clever ways around these restrictions. There are 200, 300 banks now which offer you effectively Western style financial products such as credit cards, loans, mortgages, etc., but they're structured in a way which makes them acceptable to the religious authorities.
It seems to me that if we followed them really followed these rules, no repackaging and trading debt, no short selling stocks, no risky mortgages, that at least in theory the current financial crisis in the Western world couldn't have happened under Islamic law.
No, I mean, obviously, to the extent that we're suffering from a big debt boom and a debt overhang, then a bit more Sharia law may have been useful. But if you take it to an extreme, capitalism, economic growth, whatever you want to call it, does depend on credit to a large extent. So the Middle Eastern countries have got to find a way around this. But my point is that they are doing. And I mean, you know, if you sort of turn the argument around and look at the West, you know, let's say look at a sort of nominally Christian country like the UK or the US. If you go back and look at the Bible, you know, I was brought up in Catholic schools. There's lots of the ban on usury is in the Catholic Bible as well as it is in the Quran. Jesus himself threw the money changers out of the temple and said it's, you know, it's harder for a rich man to pass. Sorry, harder for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to go to heaven. Now, he wasn't talking about a needle that you sew with. It was
Cleopatra's needle.
Cleopatra's needle.
But is that why we don't have any Catholic bankers in America?
I think there are some Catholic bankers, Leonard. I mean, the company called Merrill Lynch, you may have heard of, doesn't exist anymore because it got bought out. But as far as I understand, there were quite a lot of Irish Catholics working for it.
Who monitors Islamic finance? Who decides what's halal and haram?
That's a good question. I don't know the exact details. I mean, I guess there must be departments of each of these religious authorities, but my knowledge doesn't extend to, you know, which department in Saudi Arabia you have to deal with if you want to take out a car loan or whatever.
You write about inheritances. How were they a hindrance to economic growth?
Well, I mean, the inheritance thing is an interesting one. There's a chap down at Duke called Timur Kuran, who's a well-known economic historian who wrote one of the books that I mentioned in my piece. And his argument is, okay, you know, there's all this stuff in the Quran, but there are ways around that. So he doesn't make that argument directly, but he says there are actually some more practical things about Islam and the sort of religious inheritance we did have an impact. And one of the ones he fixes on is inheritance laws. Basically, the Islamic inheritance laws are a lot more customs rather than laws, a lot more egalitarian than in the West. Primogeniture, where you just give everything to your son, eldest son, which was a sort of Western rule, doesn't exist in Islam. You've got to divide most of your property among all your heirs. And a lot of these, in a lot of Islamic countries, the rich practice polygamy, so they had a lot of heirs. So what that effectively did, it meant that if you build up a large fortune on your death, it tended to get split up. And the argument is that Quran and others make is that that prevented the emergence of sort of Islamic Rockefellers or Carnegies or whoever, you know, big industrial corporations and big industrialists. And there may be something in that. I mean, I think you can push it too far, but that I think, you know, that's a practical consequence rather than a sort of theological thing.
My guest is John Cassidy. He's written an article called Profit Motive for The New Yorker. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with John Cassidy of The New Yorker. His latest article, Profit Motive, about finances in Muslim countries, which of course varies from country to country. But your research goes back as far as medieval times. Didn't the Middle East have a strong trading market then?
Well, that's the thing which a lot of people ignore when they look at the Middle East. I mean, if you go back 1,000 years when the original caliphate, which Muhammad and his successors set up, was in effect or was still existing, it was actually an enormous trading empire. People think of it as a religious empire looking back, and a lot of the fundamentalists sort of stress that side of it because they want to restore it. But actually, what it was a great trading empire, which, you know, traded goods, spices, all sorts of things from all the way in Spain, because they took over Spain, some parts of Spain, all the way to the Himalayas and Central Asia. It was the biggest trading empire that ever really existed, and, you know, until the British Empire came along in the sort of 17th, 18th century. And it was based on commerce and actually some quite advanced financial institutions for the, you know, for 1,000 years ago.
Well, the spice trade was a key to European cuisine, and that all came through the Middle East.
No, it? Well, you know, there was the great overland route to Asia, which went right through the Arabian Peninsula, what's now, and, you know, what's now the Suez Canal. That was sort of the nexus, not just of spices, but of, you know, a lot of sort of human knowledge. They were the only people who were really traveling around the world, and you know, that's in those days, that's how knowledge got transmitted. They didn't just trade spices. I mean, in what is now in Egypt and other places, they developed what were effectively manufacturing industries. You know, carpets, types of paper, papyrus, and other types of sort of textiles. You know, very modern for their day. The big question is, you know, how did this, what was for its day a very modern empire, sort of turn inward and fall behind the West?
They brought the zero to the West from India.
Oh, they did, yeah.
And that changed the way people did mathematics.
Oh, the whole, yeah, sure. The whole numeral system, as you say, came from Asia via the traders. A lot of the sort of original bookkeeping techniques, which later developed into double entry bookkeeping, which, you know, very, they sound boring, but they're actually very important to commerce. It's hard to imagine them commerce existing without them, came from these sort of great traders.
So the question many people ask, you just alluded to it, is what happened? Why did this thriving economy, the center of learning in Alexandria and elsewhere, a much more advanced culture in Spain than the rest of Europe when the Moors were in control of Spain. Why did all of that fall behind?
Well, that's, you know, that's the great debate, Leonard. I mean, there's basically two sides to it. The one side is to sort of blame Islam, and the argument is that Islam over the years became a very inward-looking conservative religion and sort of became anti-modern in a sense, resented any sort of modern inventions as Western and as sort of anti-Muhammad's will. That's the argument that is put forward by people like, was put forward by people like Bernard Lewis after 9/11. And, you know, there's something in that. It's certainly true that Islam did become more restrictive over the years. But that was linked, didn't just happen in isolation. It was linked to what is happening to these countries. They were basically colonized by first the Mamluks from the Caucasus and then by the Ottoman Turks. And the Ottoman Turks in particular were basically warriors. They had no interest in commerce. Or their only interest in the Middle East was in sort of raising taxes from the people of Egypt and places like that to finance their armies. And that's the sort of counter-argument that, I mean, it's an early form of colonialism, although the Ottomans obviously eventually did convert to Islam. So it was sort of internal colonialism in a way. But basically, it was bad governance. You know, a predatory government came in, stomped down on entrepreneurs, raised taxes to everybody. If you made a lot of money, basically you had to give it to the, to the Sultan.
Did all of this colonial history lead to what has been called the Muslim inferiority complex?
Well, I mean, that, you know, I really don't think I'm expert enough to answer that because I just haven't studied the sort of, you know, the primary source material in sort of 15th, 16th, 17th century Muslim countries. I think you'd have to go back and look at the actual literature there to see whether how far this inferiority complex existed then. I think we can certainly say that in the 20th century there does appear to have been an inferiority complex in some of these countries, which was linked to a sort of feeling that, it was basically been sat on by the West. And I think that is that's obviously the fundamentalists themselves make this argument that we've had this inferiority complex, we've got to throw it off and reclaim our role as the sort of, the world leaders.
Well, how does that work? We talk about radical Islam, and the first name that comes to mind is Osama bin Laden, the right. son of a very rich man. He inherited a lot of money and uses that to further his Islam, whatever his radical goals, at the same time, and uses Western technology at the same time that he condemns it?
Well, that's the great paradox about modern fundamentalism, that it was based on the sort of oil wealth of Saudi Arabia. I mean, Saudi Arabia set up a lot of these madrasas in, not just in Saudi Arabia itself, but in Pakistan, for example. The sort of growth of radical Islam in Pakistan can be largely traced to sort of Saudi Arabian oil wealth ultimately, which again sort of traces back to, the sort of Western decision to impose the Saudis on the people. I mean, the Saudi Arabian monarchy has basically used fundamentalism as a diversionary tactic, as far as I know, to sort of keep the people down. You know, it's the sort of opiate of the masses argument.
They made the deal with the Wahhabis.
Exactly. I mean, that was,
and maintained peace as a result.
And also, if 90% of the Saudi Arabian population are, too busy sort of being religious every day, they won't have time to try and take some of the money and power off the royal family.
John Cassidy's latest article for The New Yorker is called Profit Motive. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. The UN issued a report in 2002 that found that the Middle East development is restricted by its freedom deficit and knowledge deficit.
Right.
Don't many of these countries have very well-educated middle classes?
Well, they do, but they're relatively small. I mean, I think that was an important report I mentioned there, because it was put together by Arab intellectuals rather than outsiders coming in and saying this is what you should do. And it's sort of become the gold standard for looking at what's wrong with these countries. The freedom deficit's pretty obvious. I mean, a lot of these countries are run by undemocratic regimes. The knowledge deficit is different. You're right. There are sort of – Egypt, for example, has got a very educated elite, almost all of whom were educated in the UK. Same in Iraq before the war. If you were a smart Iraqi, you got sent to London to one of the British universities. But outside that very small elite, there's very little sort of scientific research, and a lot of the exiles tended to remain exiles. They'd go to Britain or somewhere and stay there. If you just look at the number of sort of number of scientific patents which are issued in the Middle East, if you look at the number of foreign books which are translated, it's very small. I mean, that's one of the arguments which Bernard Lewis and people make, that virtually no foreign books were translated after the 17th, 18th century in a lot of these countries, and I think that is a fair point.
Well, we're seeing fewer and fewer foreign books translated in the United States right now. I don't know where that's going to lead us.
Well, I think we're lucky because English is now the language of science and technology, so we can get away without reading too much foreign. And that may change, obviously. But
well, you mentioned some attempts to change things. Mehmet Ali, who was an Albanian,
yeah.
who ruled Egypt for a while, the Shah.
Yeah.
But why has Turkey been able to succeed when others haven't?
Well, I mean, that's one of the major points of my piece, I think. Turkey is the great counterexample. I mean, I think, if you ask the men on the street in England or America, they would say, look, these countries, they're never going to get it together. There's a lot of skepticism about whether Islamic countries can make the conversion to modernity, and especially to modernity with democracy. And Turkey is the great counterexample because of, it used to be a military regime. But in the last 20 or 30 years, it doesn't get much coverage in the US, but it's actually transformed itself into a very vibrant economic democracy. The army doesn't play anything like the role they used to play. There's a democratic government, which is actually a former Islamic party, but it's very open to foreign trade. Turkey is now a great trading power. It should really be admitted into Europe, but the French and the Germans, for various reasons, won't let them in.
It's the 15th largest economy in the world.
Yeah, it's
That's 15th. That's pretty impressive.
It is very impressive. And it's also, I mean, I knew it was a big economy, and I knew it was a big exporter of things like glassware and agricultural goods and hazelnuts and things like that. But it turns out, I was over there a couple of years ago, Turkey's also, developing what much higher value manufacturing. For example, they manufacture a hell of a lot of buses and cars and trucks and things now. A lot of the German auto plants are now being shifted to Turkey. So Turkey is actually following the sort of Asian model where you start off at the bottom making very simple goods and then move up the value chain. And that's how you turn into a rich country. Turkey's doing that, and, you know, it's 99% Muslim. Now, of course, the key thing in Turkey was that they did have a specific moment when they said it's time to sort of downsize religion. We're going to have a church-state divide. That happened in the 20s with Atatürk. And, you know, I think you do need to do that at some point.
A finalist for the New York City cab is a Turkish car company.
Yeah, is that true? I didn't know that. Yeah.
But what about the largest Islamic country in the world, or the one with the largest population, Indonesia?
Well, that's another very interesting example. I mean, Indonesia 20, 30 years ago was obviously dirt poor. Indonesia is basically, it's interesting for various reasons. One, because it's dragged itself up very effectively. If you just look at the sort of economic numbers, they now got a sort of mid-ranking income per capita, and they got very long life expectancies. Education, sort of percentage in secondary education has gone up. Indonesia is, it's not a sort of Western country, but it's pretty modern by sort of global standards. And it was, but it's obviously not, it's now a democracy, but it wasn't done by sort of adopting the IMF view of the world. Suharto was incredibly corrupt by all accounts. But it just shows you that you don't have to completely get rid of corruption to modernize the economy. What you need is sort of regularized corruption so that businesses know who they're dealing with, rather than sort of just chaotic corruption where you have to pay off everybody.
Well, there's a lot of corruption in Egypt and Tunisia as well, but both of them managed to grow economically better than many of their neighbors, and yet they have both had that didn't squelch the discontent.
Well, I mean, the argument I make actually about Egypt and Tunisia is that this is not a sort of revolution of desperation. It was a revolution of aspiration. And actually, the reason why these things have happened is because they were developing a sort of educated middle class. If you think where revolutions come from, people always think, you know, it's just the sort of sans-culottes on the street, starving people, demanding change because of the sort of 1789 model. But that's actually not true. I mean, you can usually just sort of, you know, crack a few heads and stomp those sort of people down. What you need to really threaten a regime like Mubarak or Gaddafi is for the middle classes, the influential, educated people, to turn against it. And that's what happened in both Tunisia and in Egypt.
But you say that both Tunisia and Egypt face a much larger problem, which is demography.
Well, that's the other issue which we haven't touched on yet. One of the things that happens when you become a modern country is the death rate falls very rapidly. So a lot of people, especially infant mortality rates, and that has happened in the Middle East, and it's led to this enormous demographic boom. The median age in a lot of these countries is, I think in Tunisia it's 19 or something. In Egypt, I think it's 22, 23. And also at the same time, they've expanded their education system quite significantly under pressure from the IMF and the World Bank and people who are lending them money. So you've got this enormous number of quite well-educated people who graduate or just drop out of college or whatever, and there are no high-paying jobs for them. And that's what we've seen in the street, you know, in Tahrir Square, etc. These people are educated. They can set up Facebook pages, etc. And it's very difficult to, you know, if you usually if a regime's in trouble, they just sort of increase the bread subsidies and, think people go away and go back to their villages or whatever. But if you think from Mubarak, what could he do to sort of satisfy these people? The only thing he could do was, you know, was leave the country.
Well, we have a number of people in this country who are upset by what's going on. John Bolton, for example, Glenn Beck and others. I suspect that the U.S. role in these countries, whether all the rebellions succeed or not, will make things a lot more difficult for a smooth transition.
Well, you know,
I mean, if we are the model and we are also seen as the enemy, how does that work?
Well, are we seen as the enemy? I don't know. I mean, it seems to me that there's too much focus on the sort of internal debate in the U.S. What John Bolton thinks, what sort of Glenn Beck thinks, what John Boehner thinks. Nobody really cares what's happening in the U.S. The
it actions is Boehner, by the way.
Boehner, sorry. The actions in the streets over there, it's not here. I mean, it reminds me of what happened after the Berlin Wall fell when I was in Washington. And, you know, there was this great debate about whether Thatcher and George H.W. Bush were being vigorous enough in supporting the people on the streets, or Mrs. Thatcher was famously reluctant to have a united Germany again. And, you know, it became a big sort of political battle and debate, but it didn't add up to anything in the end. I mean, the big question is what's going to happen on the streets and in Egypt and Tunisia and Libya. And, you know, we'll have to live with whatever happens.
Well, can they actually apply the economic success models of countries like China or India?
Well, that's the great thing. I mean, I'm actually, in this debate, I'm one of the relative optimists. I mean, the point I'm making in the piece is that there is a sort of growth model out there if they can adopt it. And, you know, the very fact that these are Islamic countries is not a sufficient sort of condition to hold them back. Indonesia and Malaysia are the great examples, which is, you know, contradict that. They basically integrated themselves into the global economy. They followed the Asian model, which doesn't look like it's going to be an option for Egypt and Tunisia if they have democracies. But, you know, in
but
terms
they could
of,
do the Turkish model.
They could do the Turkish model, exactly. I mean, basically, you've just got to have some stability, open up to foreign investment, and you know, try and educate the people. And they're some way there.
John Cassidy's article, Profit Motive, is in the current issue of The New Yorker. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you very much.